Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast of excellence. We're going to read a full chapter today. Special treat. Full chapter. Chapter 1 of Book 2. But first let's talk about Chapter 30 of Book 1. Random musings, says Swim, said the Mama Fishy. I understand why these longer chapters need to be broken into parts, but Chapter 30 was especially frustrating to comment on, partially. Yeah, it was a bit hard with it in thirds. It's a result of me having a very busy weekend and it being a very long chapter. And yeah, I just had to break it up. Laura Y. Stitch said, I actually thought it split quite well. There were three different events in the chapter and you split exactly after each. Thanks for saying that. I tried to find good spots to split it up. I'm always... When I need to split up a chapter, I skim through and just look at the first kind of word of every paragraph and look for a bit where it says the next day or 3 days later or something like that. So I think I did all right, but I do understand it's a bit annoying splitting them up all the time. So we'll read a full chapter today, even though it's a 10-pager. It's quite a long chapter. We'll fly through it. Swim, said the Mama Fishy, also said, we went from political manoeuvrings to Julian's booty call to him fleeing with bullets whizzing. I'm still feeling flummoxed. I just want to shake Louise de Renal until her teeth rattle. Julian is not worth it. On the other hand, I admire her chutzpah. Julian is worth it. Julian absolutely made the right decision to go to Paris rather than settle for the timber business. That may be my bias, though. I went to the big city and had adventures galore. The love story is less interesting to me than the politics/history, though current events at the same time. I'm looking forward to Julian's Parisian adventures. Non-creative handle said, yes, so much happened over the course of the last chapter it was hard to break what was happening, where. Made it particularly a fun read, though, when I went back and looked at it as a whole. Non-creative handle said, to add to my comment from the previous chapter, so much has happened in the course of the first part of this story. Julian as a character has grown immensely and has gone from being a peasant to practically a convict. Reflecting on this story, although there is a romance to it, I love that that is not the focal point of the story. The story has been about this young man trying to leave his mark on the world and having an affair with his boss's wife, joining the seminary, falling in love at the cafe, are all things that he just happens to do throughout the personal journey. I too am excited to see where the road to Paris leads him and what happens to the characters he is left behind, namely Louise and Father Chelan. Onwards, hey? Off to Paris we go. I'm actually kind of excited to start this next part of the book and see what happens to our young Julian. Book 2 starts with a pre-word that says, she's not pretty, she's not wearing rouge. That's Saint Beuve. And the first chapter is called The Pleasures of the Countryside. Or Rus Quando Ego Ti Apsiciam, Virgil. Monsieur is no doubt waiting for the mail coach to Paris, said the host of an inn where he had stopped to have breakfast. Either today or tomorrow, it doesn't matter much to me, said Julian. The mail coach arrived while he was pretending indifference. There were two free places. What, it's you, my poor Felcoz, cried a passenger who was arriving from the Genevan side of the man mounting the coach at the same time as Julian. I thought you'd settled down near Lyon, replied Felcoz, in a beautiful valley by the Rhone. Settled down nicely. I'm running away. What, you running away? You, Saint-Gurard, with your judicious air. You've committed some crime, said Felcoz, laughing. My God, I might as well have. I'm running away from the frightful life one leads in the provinces. As you know, I love the freshness of the woods and the calm of the meadows. You've often accused me of being a romantic. All my life I've never wanted to hear about politics, but politics is driving me away. But what party are you? None, and that's what's done for me. Here's my political creed. I love music and painting. A good book is a significant happening for me. I'm going to be 44 years old. How long do I have to live? 15, 20, 30 years more or less? All right. I hold that in 30 years' time, ministers will be a little more skilled, but exactly as honest as they are today. I use the history of England as a mirror for our future. You'll always find a king who wants to extend his prerogative. Always find rich provincials who are kept awake at night by ambitions to be a deputy, but, and by the glory, and those hundreds of thousands of francs that Mirbeau got for himself. They call it being liberal and loving the people. You'll always find the ultras fired up by the desire to be a peer or a gentleman of the chamber. Everybody wants to busy themselves steering the ship of state because it's so well paid. So will there never be a little bit of space for a simple passenger? Well, while it ought to be a very comfortable one for a peaceful character like yours, was it these last elections that forced you out of your province? My trouble harks further back. 4 years ago I was 40, and I had 500,000 francs. Today I am 4 years older and probably 50,000 francs poorer. I'm about to lose that in the sale of my chateau at Montfleury, a wonderful site. In Paris I was fed up with the perpetual posturing that forced on one by what you call 19th century civilization. I yearned for the benevolence and simplicity. I bought some land in the mountains near the Rhone, and you know earth hasn't anything to show more fair. For the first 6 months the local curé and the minor gentry paid court to me. I gave a dinner for them. I have left Paris, I said to them, in order to have neither to talk about nor hear about politics. As you know, I subscribe to no journals. The fewer letters the postman brings, the better I like it. This wasn't to the curé's taste. Soon I'm the object of 1,000 importunate demands, schemes, etc. I wanted to give 200 or 300 francs a year to the poor, and so demands come in for donations to religious associations, those of St. Joseph, the Virgin, etc. I refuse, so hundreds of insults follow. I'm stupid enough to be angry. I can no longer go out in the morning to enjoy the beauty of our mountains without finding some tiresome circumstance to distract me from my dreams and give me a disagreeable reminder of mankind and its malice. At the Rogation-tide processions, the example, whose chant pleases me, it's probably an ancient Greek melody, they won't bless my fields because the curé said they belonged to an infidel. A pious old peasant woman's cow dies. She says it's because it has been near a pond that belongs to the unbelieving me, a free thinker from Paris, and a week later I find all my fish belly upwards poisoned with lime. Deceit surrounds me in every shape. The justice of the peace, a decent fellow, but afraid for his job, finds against me every time. Rural peace is hell for me. Once it's clear that I've been abandoned by the curé, the head of the congregation in the village, and am not supported by the retired captain, head of the liberals, everyone falls on me, down to the mason I've kept in work for a year, down to the wheelwright who tried to get away with cheating me when he fixed my ploughs. So, as to get a foothold, to win at least some of my lawsuits, I make myself into a liberal. But, as you just said, these diabolical elections come along, and my vote was asked for. For some unknown? Not at all. For a man I knew only too well. I refused, a terribly rash thing to do. And from that moment, with the liberals on my back as well, my position became intolerable. I think that if it had entered the curé's head to accuse me of having murdered my servant, there would have been 20 witnesses from both of the parties who would have sworn that they had seen the crime. You wanted to live in the country without catering to the passions of your neighbours, without even listening to their chatter. What a mistake. Well, it's made up for at last. Montfleury is for sale. I'll lose 50,000 francs if I have to, but I'm overjoyed. I'm leaving that hell of hypocrisy and scheming. Now I'm looking for solitude and rural tranquility in the only place they exist in France, on the fourth floor, overlooking the Champs-Élysées. And I'm still trying to make up my mind whether to begin my political career by supplying the bread to the blessed in the parish of Roule. None of this would have happened to you under Bonaparte, said Felcoz, his eyes glinting with indignation and regret. Well, yes, maybe, but why didn't he know how to stay put? Your Bonaparte. All that I'm suffering today, it's him who caused it. Here Julien's attention redoubled. He had realized from the first that this Bonapartist Felcoz was the old childhood friend who had been repudiated by Monsieur de Renal in 1816, and that the philosophic Saint Gerard must be the brother of that chief secretary to the prefecture of Dash, who knew how to have municipal property let to him on such advantageous terms. And all of it, it's your Bonaparte's work, continued Saint Gerard. An honest fellow, inoffensive as can be, 40 years old and in possession of 500,000 francs, cannot set himself up in peace in the provinces. Bonaparte's nobles and priests chase him away. I don't speak ill of him, cried Felcoz. France's prestige among the nations has never been pitched so high as during the 13 years of his reign. and there was a grandeur then in everything one did. Your emperor, devil take him, replied the man of 44, was great only on the battlefield and when he reconstituted the finances around 1802. What can one say about his behaviour after that, with his chamberlains, his pomp and his receptions at the Tuileries? He created a new version of all the idiocies of the monarchy. It was a revised version, and it might have served for a century or two. The nobles and the priests have reverted to the old style, but they haven't the fist of iron needed to sell it to the public. Listen to the ex-printer's style. Who was it hounded me for my land, continued the printer angrily. The priests that Napoleon recalled by his concordat, instead of treating them like doctors or lawyers or astronomers and seeing them as just as citizens without bothering about how they earned their living. And where would those insolent gentry be today if Bonaparte hadn't made them barons and counts? No, the fashion for such thing had gone. Next, the priests. It was those pretty country nobility who riled me so much and forced me to become a liberal. This conversation was endless. Its subject will preoccupy France for another half century. Since St. Gerard kept on saying that it was impossible to live in the provinces, Julian's modesty proposed the example of Monsieur de Renal. Good Lord, young man, you're a fine one, cried Falcoz. He's become the hammer to avoid being the anvil, and a terrible hammer at that. But I see him being outflanked by Valenod. Do you know that scoundrel? He's the real thing. What'll your Monsieur de Renal say when he sees himself thrown out one of these fine days and Valenod put in his place? He'll be left face to face with his own crime, said St. Gerard. So you know Verrieres, do you, young man? Very well. Bonaparte, heaven confound him, made possible the reign of Renal and Chelan, which now ushers in the reign of Valenod and Mazelin. This conversation about dismal political intrigues dismayed Julian and distracted him from his deep dreams of pleasure. He was not particularly conscious of his first sight of Paris, glimpsed in the distance. The construction of castles in Spain woven round his future struggled with the still vivid memories of the 24 hours he had just spent in Verrieres. He swore to himself never to abandon his lover's children and to drop everything to go to their rescue if the high-handedness of the clergy precipitated a republic and a persecution of the nobility. What would have happened on the night of his arrival at Verrieres if, when he had propped his letter against Madame de Renal's bedroom window, he had found the place occupied by a stranger or by Monsieur de Renal? But also what bliss the first 2 hours when his mistress really did want to send him away, and when he pleaded his cause, seated beside her in the darkness, a soul like Julian's is pursued by such memories throughout life. The rest of their interview was already becoming confused with the first epoch of their love 14 months before. Julian was awoken by his profound reverie, by the coach coming to a stop. They had just entered the courtyard of the post office in Rue J.J. Rousseau. I wish to go to Malmaison, said he to the cab, which drew up. At this time of day, monsieur, to do what? What's that to you? Drive on. All true passion is an end only in itself. That is why passions are so absurd. In Paris, it seems to me, where one's neighbour is always insisting that one thinks so much about him, I refrain from writing of Julian's transports of feeling at Malmaison. He wept. What, in spite of those hideous white walls built this year, cutting the park into bits? Yes, monsieur, since for Julian, as for posterity, there is nothing dividing Arcoli, St. Helena, and Malmaison. That evening, Julian hesitated a good deal before venturing into a playhouse. He had curious ideas about these places of perdition. His deep-rooted mistrustfulness inhibited him from admiring the Paris living around him. He was moved only by the monuments left by his hero. So here I am at the centre of intrigue and hypocrisy. Here reign the patrons of the Abbé Frilair. On the evening of the third day, curiosity defeated his plan of getting to see everything before presenting himself to the Abbé Pirard. This priest coldly explained to him the kind of life that awaited him in Monsieur de la Mole's household. If at the end of a few months you are not found to be useful, you will go back to the seminary, but by the front door. You're going to lodge with the Marquis, who is one of the greatest noblemen in France. You'll wear a black suit, but like someone in mourning, not an ecclesiastic. I insist that 3 times a week you go to pursue your theological studies at a seminary to which I introduce you. Every day, at noon, you'll settle down in the Marquis's library. He expects to employ you in preparing letters for his lawsuits and other business. He'll jot a couple of words in the margin to indicate the kind of response to be made to every letter he receives. I've undertaken that by the end of 3 months, you'll be competent to compose the answers so that out of a dozen you present for the Marquis's signature, he will be able to sign 8 or 9. At 8 o'clock each evening, you'll tidy the office up, and 10, you'll be free. It's possible, A. Pirard continued, that some old lady or soft-spoken man will dangle great advantage in front of you, or even shamelessly offer you gold to get a look at the letters the Marquis receives. Ah, monsieur, cried Julian, flushing. It's odd, said the Abbe, with a bitter smile, that poor as you are, and after a year in the seminary, you're still capable of righteous indignation. You must really have been blind. Could it be the workings of his blood, said the Abbe softly, as if talking to himself. What's strange, he added, looking at Julian, is that the Marquis knows you. I don't know how. He'll give you a salary of 100 louis to start with. He's a man who acts solely on impulse. That's his failing. He'll compete with you in childishness. If he's satisfied, your salary could rise eventually to 8,000 francs. But you must be fully aware, resumed the Abbe in a sharp voice, that he's not going to give you all that money for your pretty face. You've got to be useful. If I were you, I'd talk very little, and above all, never talk about what you don't understand. Oh, said the Abbe, and I've obtained some information for you. I'd forgotten Monsieur de Lamotte's family. He has 2 children, a daughter and a son of 19, the height of elegance, and a kind of madman who doesn't know at noon what he'll do at 2. He has wit and some courage. He fought in Spain. The Marquis hopes, goodness knows why, that you'll make friends with this young Comte Norbert. I've said that you're a great Latinist. Perhaps he counts on your teaching his son some ready-made phrases about Cicero and Virgil. In your place, I'd never allow myself to be chafed by the exquisite young man, and before you respond to his advances, no doubt they'll be perfectly polite, if a little spoiled by irony, I'd make him repeat them more than once. I won't conceal you from that this young Comte de la Mole is sure to despise you at first, for you're nothing but a petit bourgeois. He is descended from a courtier who had the honour to have his head struck off at the Place de Grève on April 26, 1574, for a political intrigue. You're the son of a carpenter from Verrières, and furthermore paid wages by his father. Ponder the difference and study the history of this family, and Morieri, all the flatterers who dine at their house, make what they call delicate allusions to it from time to time. Take care how you respond to the pleasantries of Monsieur le Comte Norbert de la Mole, Major of Hussars and future peer of France, and don't come running to me for sympathy in the future. It seems to me, said Julian, flushing deeply, that I ought not even to talk to a person who scorns me. You've no notion of that kind of scorn. It'll show itself only in exaggerated compliments. If you're a fool, you'll let yourself believe them. If you wish to make your fortune, you ought to let yourself believe them. The day that all this ceases to appeal to me, said Julian, will I be thought ungrateful if I return to my little room, number 103. Doubtless all the family's toadies will slander you, but then I'll appear on your behalf myself at some qui fici. I'll say your decision was prompted by me. Julian was distressed by the sharp, almost malicious tone he felt in Monsieur Pirard's speech. It spoiled this last remark entirely. The truth was that the Abbe had erected conscientious scruples about loving Julian, and that it gave him a kind of religious dread to involve himself in the fate of another person. You'll also encounter, he added, with some ill grace, and as though performing a painful duty, you will encounter Madame la Marquise de la Mole. She is a large, fair-haired woman, pious, lofty, perfectly polite, and still more perfectly undistinguished. She's the daughter of the old Duke de Chorlez, notorious for his aristocratic prejudices. This great lady is a sort of abstract in high relief of the fundamental characteristics of women in her rank. She won't conceal, not she, that to have ancestors who went on a crusade is the sole quality she admires. Money comes a long way after that. What, that surprises you? We are no longer in the provinces, my friend. In her salon, you will meet plenty of great nobles who will talk about the princes in oddly frivolous tones. As to Madame de la Mole, she respectfully lowers her voice when she mentions a prince, or above all, a princess. I don't advise you to speak of Philip II or Henry VIII as monsters in front of her. They were kings, and that gives them inalienable rights to the respect of all, and above all, to that of those of no birth, like you and me. However, added Monsieur Berard, we are priests, for she'll take you for one, and under this appellation she considers us as lackeys essential to her salvation. Monsieur, said Julian, it seems to me that I shan't be in Paris long. Well, we'll see, but understand that for a man of our cloth there is no road to fortune except through the high nobility, and because of that, at least to me, inexplicable quality you have in your make-up, if you aren't a success, you'll be persecuted. There's no middle way for you. Make no mistake. People see that it gives you no pleasure when they address you. In a social nation like this, one you're bound to suffer if you don't command respect. What would have become of you at Bazacon without this whim of Monsieur de la Mole? One day you'll realize the extent of the extraordinary nature of what he's done for you, and if you aren't a monster, you'll feel an eternal gratitude to him and his family. How many poor clerics, more learned than you, have lived for years in Paris with their 15 sous for mass and their 10 sous for making an argument at the Sorbonne? Do you remember what I told you last winter of the first years of that Rouge Cardinal Dubois? Does your pride lead you, by any chance, to imagine that you're more talented than he was? I myself, for example, a peaceable and middling kind of fellow, I counted on spending my last years in my seminary. I'd be childish enough to become attached to it. Very well, I was about to be thrown out when I handed in my resignation. Do you know how big my fortune was? I had 520 francs in capital, neither more nor less, not a friend, and hardly two or three acquaintances. Monsieur de la Mole, whom I'd never seen, whisked me out of this nasty spot. He had only to say a word, and they gave me a living where all the parishioners were well to do, above the course of vices, where the emolument shames me. It's so little proportionate to the work I do. I only lecture you so long like this to get a little ballast into that head of yours. A final word, I have the misfortune to be short-tempered. It's possible that you and I will cease to be on speaking terms. If the Marquis's haughtiness of her or her son's tiresome pleasantries should really make the household intolerable to you, I advise you to go and complete your studies in some seminary 30 leagues from Paris, and preferably in the north rather than the south. There's more of civilization in the north, and less injustice, and he added, lowering his voice, I must confess the neighbourhood of the Paris press frightens pretty tyrants. Petty tyrants, sorry. If we continue to find pleasure in one another's company, and the Marquis's household still doesn't suit you, I offer you a place as my assistant vicar, and I'll go halves with you in what the living yields. I owe you that. And more, he added, interrupting Julian's thanks, for the extraordinary offer you made me at Bezacon. If instead of my 520 francs I'd possessed nothing, you would have saved me. The abbe's voice had lost its biting tone. To his great shame, Julian felt tears coming to his eyes. He was dying to throw himself into the arms of his friend. He couldn't stop himself saying, in the most manly tones he could manage, I've been hated by my father from the cradle. That's one of my great misfortunes, but I'll no longer complain of my luck, for I've found another father in you, monsieur. Very well, said the abbe, embarrassedly. Then, finding a formulation most appropriate to the director of a seminary, you must never say luck, always say providence. A fiacre pulled up. The coachman lifted the bronze knocker on an immense door. It was the Hotel de la Mole, and these words were to be read in black marble above the door so that passers-by could be in no doubt. This display displeased Julian. They were so scared of Jacobins. They imagined Robespierre and his tumbrils behind every hedge, so much so that they were often absurd, and then they advertised their house so that if there was an uprising, the mob would recognize it and pillage it. He communicated this thought to the abbe Pirard. Ah, poor child, you'll soon be my assistant. What a dreadful idea to come to you. I find nothing more obvious, said Julian. The gravity of the porter, and above all the cleanliness of the courtyard, struck him with wonder. It was a fine sunny day. What magnificent architecture, he remarked to his companion. He was appreciating one of those very flat-fronted mansions on the Faubourg Saint-Germain, built about the time of the death of Voltaire. Never have fashion and beauty been so far removed from one another. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Oh, have your say about that. Kicking off book two over at the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.